At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
This is Leslie Kane, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined on today's show by a professor of philosophy at Benedictine University, where he specializes in the philosophy of mind, aesthetics, philosophy of religion, and phenomenology. He is also the author of the wonderful Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy, and the End of the World. I'd like to welcome to the podcast Dr. James Madden, or as I'll be calling him, Jim. Jim, welcome to the pod.
Excellent. Thanks, Andy. It's an honor to be here. As I mentioned before, I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm resisting the temptation to fanboy all over you. So.
Whatever that might look like, go for it. it's a weird thing for me still that people listen. So actually, very strangely, happened in my work recently for the first time ever. My 9-to-5 day job, Someone turned up and found out I have this podcast because someone told them, and they were like, "Oh, I like UFOs. What's your podcast called?" And I told them, and he was like, "Oh my god, is that you?" And showed me he'd been listening to it on Spotify the day before. So yeah, that was a kind of weird one, but yeah, less about me, more about the guests, and it's all about you today, Jim.
I had an interesting experience similar to that. It was
Come on.
Literally 2 days after my book on the phenomenon came out, a student in one of my classes that I teach, an in-person class, said, "A friend of mine's mom asked me to ask you if you're the person who wrote that book." And this was literally like 2 days after it came out. Like, it was, I couldn't believe how connected everything was, you know. So.
Yeah, and do you know what? A lot of folks might look at the synchronicities around this and, well, it's meant to be. It's a good sign. It's all positive. And yeah, I've been wanting to get you on to discuss the book for a while. It's obviously through Ontocalypse, which is Kelly Chase and Co's company. That's where I first heard about it, and yourself. And it's been a while, so let's get down to it, Jim. I want to go back, as I do with all my guests, and talk about your own interest in the UFO subject and how far back does that go?
Sure. So for me, it doesn't go like really terribly far. You know, I'm kind of one of these Johnny come latelys on the scene of the UFO question. So, you know, I mentioned this in a lot of places. You know, if you got to know me better, Andy, you'd say like, I'm the most cliche Gen X guy you ever met. I mean, I graduated from high school in 1992. So it puts me like right in the middle, you know. And so, you know, in college and stuff, the X-Files and all that, that was all part of the popular culture, but it was never something I took really seriously. Mm-hmm. And then when the 2017, you know, New York Times stuff happened, I noticed that. And I thought, that's interesting. Like, that was weird because it was this thing that we were, my whole adult life, told that's just science fiction. If you're into it, you're just some, you know, drug-addled, you know, crazed person or something, right? And then suddenly it was sort of, well, unless maybe there's something to it. And there were authoritative people saying this. And, you know, I hate to say it, that I'm no more than anyone else, even though I'm a professional philosopher. The fact that authorities were saying it was okay to look into this, it moved the needle to me, you know. And then, you know, fast forward a few years, it's just something that, you know, I had got a casual interest in, started reading a little bit about, right, and started saying, yeah, I think there's something more to this than for a long time than just what we're being told. And then I think it was the summer of 2021. I think that was when the first real Pentagon briefing happened. And I was literally watching the X-Files with my teenage kids that summer. We're doing streaming all the old episodes. And I remember thinking when that briefing happened, like, so exactly where was Fox Mulder wrong, right? I mean, it seems like now the Pentagon is saying there's some there. And I was struck almost immediately by the fact that things that were being now reported as having happened in the early 2000s, where I had already seen, you know, things that I had read that seemed very similar phenomenologically to things that were going on in the 1960s, 1950s. So it was very hard to say that this is something that just came up now, right? Mm. And so then I started reading, really reading into it. And, you know, I read, you know, John Keel, I read Jacques Vallée, several books by Jacques Vallée. That got me, you know, led me, you know, the trail to Diana Pasulka's stuff. And then, you know, with Diana's work, now you've got someone who's working in higher ed at a fairly high level, right? At a higher level than I am. And publishing with one of the best academic publishers in the world, with Oxford, and coming at it through Martin Heidegger, who's a philosopher that I was currently at the time writing a book on that stuff, right? So I thought, okay, this is interesting. So now it's really become like I have permission to take this seriously as a professional. And then from there, you know, I took it up as a research project like I would anything else in what I do. And I was surprised how much issues in, you know, so-called ufology kind of resonated and like overlapped with issues in the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of religion that I was working on anyway, right? And so that culminated in the little book that I published last year with Ontocalypse through Kelly, Unidentified Flying Hyperobject.
Something I talked about, I can't remember when, a while ago on the podcast, because it came up that a lot of listeners get in touch with me and ask me, I'm just getting into the UFO topic. Where do you start? You know, who do you read? Who do you believe? Who do you not believe? And I think that's a really slippery slope, because then I'm telling them this is what's correct. So I like to say, you know, here's some different places to go. You've said there, you know, John Keel, Jacques Vallée, Diana Pasulka, that's a very particular route to go down. At any point where you swayed to go any other routes, you've obviously got, you know, you could go Stephen Greer, Richard Dolan, various different avenues that may end up in a similar place, but they're very different jumping off points potentially.
I like Dolan's stuff quite a bit, you know, because like, well, one, like Dolan is a legit scholar. He is, right? I mean, he's a trained historian. He's bringing those tools to bear in his work. His projects are massive, right? They are massive scholarly projects executed with method, right? So I think he's very reliable that way. I'm sure there's controversy surrounding it, right? And also, though, what Dolan is very good at is tying everything into the geopolitics and domestic American politics of the 20th century into the 21st century, okay? Mm. So I think with Dolan is you learn a lot beyond the UFO phenomena, and you learn the UFO phenomena connected to those things, okay? So I think that's very important, right? And so I do find Dolan's work very helpful, okay? I don't necessarily find, and this is no strike against Richard's work, I don't find him helpful in dealing with sort of the metaphysical issues surrounding it, but that's not really what he's up to either, right? That's not necessarily what he's trying to do. And another thing too, I want to mention about what I think is really important about Vallée's work, okay, is if you ask me like what the most important book by Vallée is, I would say it's Messengers of Deception, okay, because it's there where Vallée goes through a lot of, like, he's writing this in the late 1970s, I believe, is when that first came out. And he goes through a lot of like the very, very famous classic cases, and he starts casting doubt on a lot of them. Okay. Yeah. And he starts showing you cases where he thinks like very elaborate, you know, shams were pulled off by intelligence community and stuff like that in Europe and in South America and all that. And I think that's very important. I think it's very, very important, right? And in my ability to like trust Jacques' work, right? Because he's willing to say a lot of what you're encountering with this is not just like the phenomenon's deceptive, but there's outright put-ons going on, right? And there's exploitations of this and stuff like that. And I think that's a very important message for anybody who's getting into this and thinking about it, right? Does that make sense?
100%. I agree with that. You need to be able to say, no, that is a bug flying across a camera lens, or that's not an orb, that's dust coming across a camera, rather than make every single thing as a UFO, an alien being. I think a recent example, I don't know if you've followed it, and it's been a little bit of a divisive one as well. Quite a few things have recently, is the Las Vegas alien videos. Have you seen those?
Mm-mm.
Very long story short, there was a police report. It was the same night a meteor had gone across the sky.
Yeah.
And a family called the police. They filmed themselves in their back garden, kind of on one side of a fence, looking at what they said were two alien beings. There's been some examination of the footage by one gentleman, Ben Roder, I believe it's Scott Roder. And he says he believes from the video, the analysis shows there are beings cloaked. And that's why but for me, as a complete layman, I've seen my camera do that just because it is light on one side of the camera, very dark on the other.
Yeah.
And the camera, it's just artifacts and pixelation. And loads of folk want to see something. And it'd be very easy for me with a UFO podcast to sensationalize everything I see and be like, that's an alien, that's a UFO, there's something to this. And I'd much rather be honest and say, right now, I don't think there is something to it, but I'm always open to be convinced otherwise. So I'm absolutely with you on that.
Yeah. Now, and I'll say this. So I had the really good fortune of going to Rice University earlier this year, and I got to see the archives, the impossible that Jeffrey Kripal, you know, leads in the maintaining those archives. And I tell you, I didn't really expect this, but when you go there and you see how much material there is, okay, and how many reports there are of these things, right? And you know, he can't touch them because there's medical privacy issues, but they have, you know, the John Mack files now, and I got to see just this massive, you know, load of file boxes all full of the casework that John Mack did with people who were experiencers. And you start thinking, okay, even if just, you know, 1 or 2% or 4 or 5% of all these reports really amount to something, that's still rather significant. Okay. Yeah. So on the one hand, I think it's important to note that, yeah, probably 95% of what you encounter with all this in terms of reporting and maybe even what's written about is either, you know, mistaken or maybe intentionally put on. Right. But it only takes one anomaly to legitimate anomaly to change how you look at the world. And it does seem that there's enough of this that, and there are some very, very good cases that should lead us to take it seriously.
Why do you think then, and this is maybe a question for later, but relevant mm-hmm. now, why do you think then with the sheer volume of testimony, evidence, you know, what's happened over the decades with the UFO phenomenon, why don't we still have that one cast iron case? Not for the 1% of us who love the UFO topic and we believe and we've seen, we've experienced, you know, but the general public I'm talking about still have doubts about the legitimacy of the topic. Yeah. Why don't we have that yet?
Yeah, you know, so I like to think about this in terms of a notion that we talk about in philosophy called parity of evidence. Okay, so it's sort of like if I have a certain level of evidence or a certain reliability of evidence, you know, like to support the reality of phenomenon A, then if there are similar reliabilities of evidence supporting phenomenon B, if I go for A, I really should go for B. Okay. Mm. And if I don't go for B, then I have to ask myself, like, what are my other motivations in this? Like, why am I refusing to believe the other B on the same strength of evidence as I already admit A on this other strength of evidence? Okay. And I think, this could really get us into conspiracy stuff, but okay. I think right now, so if you ask me, do I think the US Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden? Okay, I would say yes. All right. Well, what basis do I have that on? Well, I have that on when I've seen expert witnesses on news programs say, yeah, we did that.
Yeah.
You know, so I have it on a fairly small number of expert testimonies. Okay. Well, now, if you ask me, do I think the Tic Tac incident happened? Okay. Well, what's my evidence for the Tic Tac incident? Well, it comes down to, Commander David Fravor, and was it Commander Alex Dietrich? Right. I think she's attested to it now too. Right. Mm-hmm. It's their expert testimony that I've seen on the news and in lectures and that sort of thing. Okay. So it looks like it we have parative evidence there, right? And so if someone's going to say, yeah, I think the Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden, right? It should then commit them, I think, to letting at least serious credence to something like the Tic Tac incident. Okay. So now going back more to your question is, like, you're saying, well, then why haven't we had like the knockdown drag out punch, right? Okay.
Yeah.
That would like turn the public to believe in the phenomenon, right? Well, I think it's because you do have, you know, decades now of science fiction sensationalism around this. Okay. So when people do hear about UFOs, right, they hear about UAP, they immediately think fiction. They think about things that people saw in movies, right? You do have a lot of stigma with it. Like we use, like, a slur for schizophrenic is tinfoil hat, right? And the idea is that schizophrenics often are said to wear tinfoil hats to protect them from, you know, communications from aliens, right? So think of it, like, it's become so stigmatized. We use the phenomenon as a euphemism, and a not so nice euphemism, for a kind of mental illness, right? So I think what I'm getting at here is, even though I think you have parity of evidence, right, there's still this cultural deck stacked against us that's even implicit in the unstated things about our language, right? Tinfoil hat means crazy. It also means believer in alien, right? You know, UFO means ET, right? A clearly fictional story. Do you see what I mean? All that stuff's in the implicit background in our subconscious now. That's it, that runs our beliefs in many ways if we don't really reflect on them. And so I think, yeah, even though I think the evidence is at parity with a lot of stuff we believe, maybe we shouldn't believe some of that stuff, but even though it's at parity with a lot of that, I think there's this implicit, you know, subconscious deck stacked against us, and that's what's blocking it.
Do you think we can get the evidence to show this without whatever this is? If it is an extraterrestrial race, for example, one of them visiting us in saucers, without them giving us the evidence? Because I think, interestingly, you mentioned like those US Navy SEALs. If you asked me or said to me, in this, you know, area here, in this desert, there are a bunch of trained Marines, Navy SEALs, whatever it might be, there's your iPhone. Go and get a picture of them. They're going to be hiding from you. They're better trained than you. They've got more tech than you. They know the area better than you. But go and find them. Likelihood is, I will never find them, but they will see me at all times.
Or you're not coming back alive.
So is it the same thing? Oh, yeah, you're not coming back, yeah.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is it the same with this phenomenon that we're trying to get evidence for something that is just so far advanced than is, or it doesn't want the evidence to be gotten yet? We're looking for something we can't get.
Yeah, this is an issue that I think should be discussed more. Is rightly so, people say, well, look, we gotta science this. You gotta show us how we can experimentally verify this, or at least empirically verify it one way or another. All right, but humans are not used to, and our scientific method is not designed to deal with studying something that's smarter than we are, right? That may have every reason to, you know, deceive us or something like that. Okay. So, you know, what would an experiment look like to try to verify the presence of something that is actually aware of you and understands things better than you do, right? It would seem like it would be, at that point, the experimental method is going to break down, right? Like, I think we always assume when we're doing experiments, what we're dealing with is fundamentally a predictable, right, unintelligent phenomenon, right? Or at least if we're doing social scientific experimentation, we're still taking a step back, right, and not treating ourselves as conscious beings, but treating ourselves as phenomena of nature that we can sort of track with natural laws. Okay, great. But what if the thing that we're dealing with is conscious and resistant to the process, right? And like knows what's going on? I think that's an interesting question, right? Like, if, and this becomes for me an interesting philosophical question, is if there were such a thing as a non-human intelligence in our presence, would we even expect to be able to detect it, right? And I think we have every reason to believe that we may very well not, right?
how does philosophy then, and your background in philosophy, help you understand the UFO conversation differently to someone else coming into it with maybe more of a standard background? How does it deepen your understanding of the topic or change your thinking?
Yeah, well, I think there's a number of ways, okay? And I don't want to be the snotty academic guy who comes in and says, hey, you know, thanks kids for, you know, getting ufology going for 80 years. Now the professionals here will take over, right? I don't want to be that guy, right? But I'll say this is just whether you're a professional philosopher or you're someone else working in the humanities or you're someone working in the social sciences or someone working in the natural sciences, there is a kind of methodological rigor, okay, that you're going to find out of a trained academic that you won't find in other people. Okay. And I do think, though, you know, once again, Dolan's a great example. There are people who've been working this for a long time who do have academic levels of rigor, but I do think academics in general have much to offer in that way to the field. Okay.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
And moreover, I think specifically philosophers, like people like me, I think our advantage in this is, one, we do think about evidence a lot. Okay, we do not just like specific evidence, but like what counts for evidence, right? We do think about philosophy of science quite a bit. We do think about issues in epistemology, the theory of knowledge, right? We do think of issues in the philosophy of language quite a bit, and all these things that have direct bearing here, just in the conversation we're having right now, is like what would or wouldn't be evidence for the phenomenon? What would or wouldn't be a reason to call something into doubt? Because I think that in particular is helpful in this. Okay. Not necessarily the track that I've taken so far in my treatments of it. All right. Cause where else I think philosophers can help is, you know, philosophers have, you know, brought very, very rigorous tools of logic to metaphysical questions for a couple thousand years now, right? In the West, right? And in the East, maybe longer than even, right? And we do have a good sense of what the available, you know, ontological options are, right, in terms of what's permitted logically, right? And we do have a good sense of what the upsides and downsides of those various ontologies are, okay? So I do think philosophers can be in a very good position to make proposals as to what this might be, what this might not be, right? That can then be taken over by the people doing the empirical work to try to verify it one way or another. And you see this similar relationship between philosophy and other types of empirical disciplines in other fields too.
You're coming into this topic, like you said, Johnny come lately, which is, you know, nice way to put it, putting yourself down. But you know, you've come into the topic later than most. Many enjoy it from a young age, have an experience, a sighting, an interest from early on. But you come into it then from a welcome point of view, that we've got folks who maybe haven't had a long-standing interest. They've got fresh eyes. It's a topic that's had decades, you know, of stigma, ridicule, debate, discussion. We've seen it now at the highest levels of politics and everything in between. It's gone from little green men, flying saucers, to non-human biologics and tic-tacs as the most recent kind of language. So in your head, what is your thinking of the UFO phenomenon coming into it? And we're going to kind of segue into talk about the book. But as you begin to write the book, are you at the, this is little green men, this is flying saucers, or is it something else?
Yeah, good question. So for me, going into the writing of the book, that's kind of a hard question, because when does someone start writing a book? Like, do you start writing a book about the UFO the first time you sat down at the computer with the intent to write a book, or is it the first book you picked up about the UFO, right?
Yeah.
By the time I got to the point where I was sitting down to work on it as a book, I had some pretty solid ideas of where I was going, right? I'm very much a planner. Like I'm someone, when I write a book, I have almost every paragraph outlined before I start it, right? This one unfolded a little differently, but that doesn't matter. And so my take on the what is it question of the UFO is that I don't think for the most part ufology has like taken seriously how difficult and problematic that very question is. Okay. And here's my basic worry about it is whatever the UFO is, right? Whatever this phenomenon is, it is likely something that our perceptual and cognitive apparatus has not evolved to deal with. Okay. It's likely something that was not something we were competing with in our environment as the human being was formed. It's not something that likely like we ate, right? That we hunted, right? It seems like if it's been here, and maybe it has been, if it's been here forever, it's been mostly irrelevant to the conditions under which we've evolved. Okay. And if that's the case, and we could talk about what the probability of that, but like if that's the case, it seems to me, it's not something we're set up to perceive. It's not something we're really particularly set up to think about. And so then our expectations of ever getting a hold of this thing have to be very, very low, very, very low. Okay. It's sort of like if indeed, you know, I've evolved so as to only pay attention to the red things because the red things in the room are relevant to my survival. Okay. Mm-hmm. And paying attention to purple things would just be a distraction from the red things. Okay. Eventually, what are you going to have? We're going to be honed in on red things and we're not even capable of paying attention to purple things. Okay.
Yep.
Well, with the analogy I'm drawing here is I'm saying, well, it may be that something like what we're bumping into with the UFO is like those purple things. It's just irrelevant to our ordinary way of getting around. And thereby there's a huge block between us and it when it comes to our ability to understand it, let alone even perceive it.
Yeah, I think that ties in with some of the ideas that come across in the book. So I'll reserve those questions to get into the book chat now. So the title of the book, Unidentified Flying Hyperobject. Let's talk about that title first.
Yeah.
What's the thinking? What is a hyperobject rather than just going with the standard object?
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So what I do is the book, you know, sort of executes in some phases, right? And in the first phase, I more or less make the argument that we just talked about, where I say, look, there does seem to be good reason to believe that if there were something like this phenomenon, it's outside of the realm that humans can normally perceive and cognize. And thereby we have to sort of live with the fact that it looks like we may not be a very good measure of what there is, right? And that we may be bumping into things that are just in principle beyond our ken here, okay? And then in the second phase, I say, okay, now that being said, I'm going to speculate a bit about what this might be. Okay.
Right.
Because you know, philosophers are always going beyond their pay grade, right? That's what we do. Okay. So, what I do in the second part of the book is I really play on the notion of object in unidentified flying object. Okay. So, in the first part of the book, I'm basically focusing on the unidentified part and to say, yeah, and get used to that because it may be unidentifiable. Okay. And I expect that there are unidentifiable things that we occasionally bump into. All right. Now let's get into the object thing. And I want to look at like, what do we actually mean by an object? Right. And how interesting and rich could objects be? And then go ahead and play that back into this question. Okay. And I'm drawing in that section on the work of a group of contemporary philosophers who identify themselves as the object-oriented ontology movement. Okay. And sort of the central figure of that is a guy named Graham Harman. And I strongly encourage people to check out Graham's work. He's very accessible. All right. And Harman's point is that, you know, once we admit what we talked about a minute ago, that it's probably the case that we are set up to only perceive certain aspects of things, right? Like I'm only really here, say, to use my silly example, to be concerned with the red thing because the red things are relevant to what we humans do and need. But there still could be purple aspects of things that we just miss because we weren't evolved to perceive it, okay?
Yeah.
So Harman's notion then is like all objects, to use the language he likes to use, withdraw from us, meaning there's always more to them than we perceive, or there's always more to them than we can cognize, because we humans are only going to perceive or cognize what's relevant to the perceptual and cognitive possibilities for human beings. Okay. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah.
So there's, so like I have, for those who are listening, I'm holding a seltzer water can here. Okay. And Harman would say, yeah, well, that seltzer water can, as we perceive it, is a caricature to, of its full being, right? Because we're only able to perceive what about that can is relevant to our doings and our thinkings. Okay. But then that raises the question, what else is there to the can than just what's relevant to us, right? We can't know that. Like the can, whatever the can really is, it's beyond, or not to say really, it really is as we perceive it. But what it really is more than that is beyond our perceptual powers. So in Harman's view, every object withdraws from it. It's more than just what it, what we see about it, right? He's not saying we just make it up. Like we do see an aspect of it, but there are always more aspects to it, he thinks, than are, what are available to human perception. Okay. So from Harman, we take this notion that objects, every object, even the most ordinary object, is pretty spooky. Like what is that? What is the seltzer water can really up to, right?
Yeah.
In the world outside of human perception, right? And then you start asking yourself, like, what's in this room with me right now? Like what beings are in this room with me right now? Unconscious, conscious, what have you, that just aren't relevant to human perception, right? It seems like we can't rule that out, because once we realize our perception is honed for certain very practical tasks relevant to human being, then we have to admit, yeah, it's possible that we're just missing stuff all the time. Okay. So then how many goblins and fairies are in the room right now? Right. Like who knows? Right. Okay. So now the hyperobject piece is another thinker, a guy named Timothy Morton, who's actually a literary scholar, philosopher, and he does ecological thought. Okay. And Morton, drawing on Harman's work, brings up the notion of a hyperobject. Okay, and what is a hyperobject? Well, hyperobject is an object that greatly, vastly, like outstrips humans. Okay, it operates on a spatial scale, or a temporal scale, or a scale of sophistication that is far beyond what we can fathom. Okay, and all we get of that object are just like little footprints of it, little tentacles of it, right? Little pieces of it. All right. And so for Harman, or pardon me, for Morton, okay, like an example of a hyperobject is something like an economy. Okay, so like right now, we can go look at this or that unemployment line, right? We could go look at this or that house for sale. We could go, you know, look at you know, a computer image of Andy's, you know, bursting bank account, right? We could look at all these things. But none of those are the economy, right? And whatever the economy is, it's far vaster than all of those things, right? And in fact, nobody really understands the economy. We just understand like little bits and pieces of it. And but what it's really doing is far beyond what we get, okay? And, you know, Harman himself uses the example of civil war. He thinks the civil war is an object, right? It has powers of its own. It gets up and running on its own. But yet it's an object that is like far beyond all of us. Like no one's really running the Civil War, right? The Americans, you guys had your own, right? But same for yours, right? Okay, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that one for Scotland. But anyway, I don't want to get into politics.
That's all right.
That's right. But you see what I mean? Like, and so like these historical events take on lives of their own. You know, Morton will use the example of like the Anthropocene period. Like it now seems like there's a distinct geologic period that bears the human footprint, right? And it's sort of, it's interacting with us. It arises from us originally, but it's out of our control and far beyond our ken, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So what is all this? What do I do with all this? So what I say is, look, once we realize human perceptual apparatus is not the best gauge of what there is, okay, and maybe we're just not really good at getting beyond that, nor can we. And then we realize that all objects are essentially very mysterious, and that there are objects that are far vaster than anything humans could possibly fathom. I make the suggestion then that maybe the UFO is something like a hyperobject, right? It's not just a bunch of little things. It's one great big systematic thing, like the environment, like the economy, right? like all the technology in the world or something like that, that is up and running on its own, operating at scales that we can't possibly fathom, and we get little bits and pieces of it here and there.
Right. So if I'm understanding that correctly, mm-hmm. human perceptual apparatus, you're talking ears, eyes, brain, just how we are set up to yeah. take in the information that's available to us. Yeah. So if we're not set up, and I don't completely disagree with that at all, I think that's perfectly yeah. logical to view or understand what this might be. Can we or do we have the ability to add to that apparatus to expand on it? I think the obvious one right yeah. now would be AI. Is that another tool that we can build in as a sixth or seventh sense almost to, yeah. to say, can this help us understand it?
Yeah, you know, the first human being who made a hat with a visor on a sunny day, right, expanded the apparatus, right? Because it gave opportunities for perceptual conditions that wouldn't have been available to or to pre-technological human beings. And probably yeah. there are not pre-technological human beings. It seems like technology and humans have evolved together, right? And so I think all of our technologies, especially our information technologies, are all attempts to expand the human perceptual apparatus. Okay. And then think of like, you know, a microscope, right? Think of a telescope, think of, you know, all the instrumentation we use in natural sciences, think of our smartphones, think of AI. Okay. But I'll say, so I think we are constantly expanding it. Okay. But this is the hook though, is we always have to bring it back to like the basic human package for us to like give it any concrete meaning whatsoever, right? So we make all sorts of discoveries in the natural sciences, okay, that are highly abstract and mathematical, right? But then we have to fall back and talk about waves and particles, right? We have to bring it back into a stock of metaphors that makes sense to in terms of the sort of things that like monkeys like us can look at and put our hands on. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I would say however far we expand our perceptual and cognitive, you know, hardware and software with our information technologies, they're still always limited by the basics of human biology, of the basics of human evolutionary history. Do you see that?
Yeah.
And so there's always going to be a limit. Like we can only stretch something to a point where it's no longer intelligible to human biology and thereby is no longer intelligible full stop to us. And so I think AI, all these things might help us get better and better and better and better at a look at what's out beyond our perceptual envelope. Okay. But it won't complete the job in as much as it's still a human living, breathing thing, understanding it.
If something is holding you, the kind of carrot on the stick to us as a society, as a species,
yeah.
it's always going to have that capability to move the stick or redefine what, and you find one day it's got a carrot on a stick, it redefines what the stick is, what the carrot is.
Yeah.
And
I like that analogy. Yeah. You're never going to get that carrot. Like, cause like the more you reach for it, the further it's going away from you.
Yeah. Right?
And so you do cover more territory. I grant you that, but you're never going to like, for us to ask, this is like the old Immanuel Kant point, right? Like what does the world look like independently of the conditions of humans perceiving the world is not an available perspective for us, right?
Yeah,
because we have to perceive it under the conditions that humans perceive it, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not an idealist. I'm not saying there's no real world out there. But what I'm saying is we are always only dealing with a partial piece of it, given our human limitations.
I think even if I'm understanding it properly as society, I couldn't comprehend living like an Aboriginal tribe with no internet, no books, yeah. information. That just doesn't seem like a life that would be possible for me to live. But right. then I think of people hundreds of years ago who had no TV, you know, no phones, no ways of communicating except face to face. But it's just they didn't know any differently. They didn't have a notion of the internet, TV, entertainment, podcasts, headphones.
Right.
It just wasn't a thing, so you understand it. And I think that maybe, do you think that explains in a way, as we have evolved as a society and technologically, why these objects, the physical objects themselves, seem to have evolved as well? Because classically, we've got videos and images of saucers, but they look old. Whereas yeah. now, we've got these really incredible looking fancy objects that are described seamless, metal, you know, moving at these incredible speeds. Do you think that's just a perception thing?
Yeah, I think a number of things could be going on there. Like one, it could be that, you know, the fakes evolve with our sophisticated expectations, right? So like a saucer that had like, you know, you could see the rivets and bolts were for the doors made a lot of sense when the going human technology was like World War II airplanes.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you're gonna fake one then, you'd make it look like a World War II airplane. If you're gonna fake it now, you're gonna make it look like a, you know, an F-35 fighter, right? Okay. So I think there may be some of that going on, right? But also I think more to the point, I think more interestingly is it is very clear our expectations have a lot to do with what we do or do not perceive. Okay. You know, you've heard like probably the famous social psychology experiment where, you know, they'll take subjects and have them watch people pass a basketball back and forth. Okay.
Yeah. I've seen this.
And they say, look, we want you to concentrate on the basketball. I want you to concentrate on the basketball. And they'll have a dude in a gorilla suit walk right through the middle of the scene, and people they'll miss it.
Yeah.
Even though it crosses their visual plane, but it's just not relevant to what we're doing. You'll miss it. Okay. There's great examples. I think are relevant when you get like placebo studies for drugs. Okay. So it does seem that if you're given something, an inert substance, and you're convinced though that it's not inert and it will cause you to feel less pain, your brain will select out the non-pain feelings and leave aside the pain feelings. Okay. There's very good evidence that this is how it works. Okay. So it does seem like our expectations, and I recommend a recent book by a guy named Andy Clark called The Experience Machine to see some of this, right? Our expectations really do have a lot in shaping what we are going to perceive in any given situation. Okay.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
And so, it seemed, let's now bring it back to your example, Andy, is let's say somebody in 1946 bumps into something from outside the human perceptual envelope and they have the what the F is that moment, right? And what's their brain going to do? It's going to interpret it in categories that it has, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to fit, the brain will fill that gap in with something. Okay. And it's going to fill it in with like a World War II era craft, right? Because the brain is already kind of honed in there. And let's say somebody, you know, in contemporary, you know, Scotland sees something from outside the normal human perceptual envelope and has that, you know, what the F moment, what's your brain going to do? It's going to fill it in with something, right? And what's in your subconscious imaginary now, something that's a lot like a, you know, a F-35 fighter, right? It's going to come in that way, you know? So I think you could make a good case that a lot of, and I do some of this in the book, is a lot of what's going on here is people are bumping into real things and real things that don't make sense. But then there's a human mechanism to interpret it, subconsciously interpret it. And you're going to interpret it in terms of the imaginary that's available to you given your time and place and culture, right?
Yeah. And I think as well that previous example of the gorilla walking through the basketball, you know, passing, because I've seen that myself before. There's even an idea that, you know, when five people have the same sighting, they see and view different things. And is there an element of four of them are seeing the basketball game, but one of them's watching the gorilla walk through, and they have a totally different experience, but they're all experiencing the same, you know, object or hyper object?
Exactly. And that goes a long way to explain, like, why do some people see it, some people don't? Well, you do have, not everybody goes for the trick in the basketball experiment, right? In the gorilla experiment, right? So some people, for whatever reason, are more tuned in, or just by some quirk, right? They saw it, right? There's a great example that Whiteley Strieber talks about in his most recent book, Them, where, and I analyze this at length in my book, there was someone who was actually a perceptual psychologist. I find that interesting. So this guy knew what hallucinations were, right? Was driving down a busy freeway in somewhere in the New York City area. I think it was Long Island, maybe, during rush hour. And he thinks he sees something like an airplane, but not, it was off. It was a little weird. It was going to crash into the highway and no one else sees it. And he gets off the freeway and at the off ramp, he sees, you know, like a menagerie of like maniacal clowns jumping around and then like a billboard take off like a rocket ship. And no one else sees this. Okay. Except someone else also wrote a letter to Sreeber saying, and these two men did not know each other, I saw something kind of like an airplane and kind of like maniacal clowns. So two people saw this, right? But it's interesting is, so you got to take it seriously because you have two independent people seeing phenomenologically very similar things, but apparently at least no one else reported it, saw anything like that. Okay. Well, why is that? Well, I think something like the gorilla basketball experiment really makes sense of that, right? It does seem that, you know, if we're all into something, we're trying to get home for dinner, you know, just trying to not get killed in the freeway. We're tuned into something. We'll tune out all sorts of other stuff. And other people might become distracted from that and they'll tune into this weird anomaly that's in the room, right?
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating and enchanting because once again, like what anomalies are in the room right now that I'm missing because I'm just not tuned in. It's not relevant to what I'm doing.
I think when I've spoken to folks who I work with, and I use that as an example quite a lot, and I try and take the UFO topic or conversation a little bit of a different direction than what the little green men, flying saucers kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I work for a satellite communications company. They sell TV, phone, broadband, and I'll talk about Wi-Fi because that's something that they all know about. And I'll say to them, okay, so like, what is Wi-Fi? And they'll tell you, but okay, show me it. Well, you can't yeah. show me Wi-Fi. You can show me it working. You can show me it impacting on something. You know when it's not working, but you can't physically see it yet. It's all yeah. around you. And this is probably really crude, but what I've said is, what if something lived in that Wi-Fi? What if someone on that frequency, something was existing within it? You wouldn't see it. You wouldn't know it was there, but it affects the things round about you. And try exactly. to get people just to think of something differently like that. Does that make sense?
100%. That's a great metaphor. It's a great metaphor. And we know there's, you know, frequencies of sound we don't hear. We know there's wavelengths of light we don't pick up on. We know there's smells. We know all this. We know, right, that in very small ways, the human perceptual apparatus is not the measure of what there is. Okay. And so then why not maybe in some very big ways, it's not the measure either, right? And yeah. I like the Wi-Fi thing, especially if you press people on using the Wi-Fi example, is not only can't you see it, but, you know, people like me and maybe less so people like you, but at some point you're just taking the word of other experts that there is such a thing
yeah.
beyond its effects. Do you see, you know what I mean? Like there's yeah. this whole theoretical stuff that you got trained and just took on faith that that's how it works. Right. And just think of it like that, just that, how much of what I kind of get at, like how much of our expectations are set by things that we've never questioned, right?
And just like, is.
Just is. It. Yeah,
yeah, just is.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I love that example.
Thanks. I'll keep using it then if it
yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah, you have my permission.
and on that, I think within the book, you talk about the control hypothesis. You've mentioned Jacques Vallée, something he's spoken about. And again, you're talking about things outside of our perception. Do you think they're using that advanced... Well, to them, would they even know that it's more advanced? Is it just their existence or whatever this is existence? Yeah. Is just, again, it just is. And that they're using this, you know, control system either deliberately, unintentionally, or is it... even as extreme as Jacques Vallée suggests, you know, they're almost like puppeteers, you know, famously the book, is it Passport to Magonia, that has the different masks yeah, on the front of it, really famously. What's your thoughts around the idea of that control yeah. scenario?
So I am a hyper object to the cells in my body, right? Like I'm this great big thing operating on scales of time and space that, you know, dwarf the cells that compose my body, right? And think of it like there is a central control mechanism that is my organic life, okay? But it's not even like I'm not really in conscious control of it. Like I'm not consciously running, you know, the cells in my thumb, right? Mm-hmm. But my overall organic being is, right? And so what I play with in the book is like, we might think of this as like on that kind of that analogy with an organism, right? Like organisms control all of the systems and subsystems and organs and organelles and cells that compose them through a central control system that nobody's actually really running, right? As you put it, we're just doing what we do. And yeah. What we do involves the control of these lower levels, right? And it seems like a lot of those, that kind of metaphor fits with things Valet says, right? So what I propose is like, maybe we could think of this as like, it's not like there's this alien intelligence that is consciously trying to manipulate us. It's more like we're components of a hyperobject, in the way the cells in my body are components of a hyperobject. And I'm running my cells by, you know, the influx of various enzymes and hormones and things like that. And maybe likewise, this hyperobject is running us, you know, in a conscious or unconscious way by the influx of ideation, right? Of ideas and things like that per Valet's way of looking at it, right? And so it could be that, you know, like the world is like this nested hierarchy of objects to hyperobjects, right? And we're just finding that, in fact, we're not at the top of that hierarchy, right?
Do you remember, have you seen the movie Men in Black?
Yes. Long, yeah. I saw it in the theater. I'll date myself there.
Yeah, so did I. And I think I'm about 11 years younger than you, I think, roughly. So I was a little bit younger. But I always remember, it stuck with me, the ending where they find Orion's belt, which is, you know, the cat's got the galaxy on Orion's belt. Mm-hmm. And I think that the last scene, the camera zooms in on the cat's kind of little bell, which is the galaxy, and it goes further and further and further, to the point it's almost, it's hard to actually think about, it hurts your head. It's that almost like we are just on something, some cat's bell, basically, and there's aliens playing marbles with our galaxy, and we're just so infinitesimally small. And when you're talking about, you know, the cells in your body have no idea what's outside of it. It's just that, like you say, hierarchy of things on the outside, on the outside, on the outside, you know, what's at the end of the universe? Is it just, you know, someone else's universe begins?
Yeah. I mean, I have no way of ruling that out, right? Yeah.
Probably unlikely, but still, there could just be a big wall, and then what's on the other side of the wall?
What's inside the wall, yeah.
Yeah, the other end of the same universe you've just started from. That starts to hurt my head, and the accent doesn't lend to that. So dark knowledge was something I found really interesting in the book. Can you explain to the listeners and viewers the idea of dark knowledge and what that is?
Yeah, so that's something, it's an idea I kind of floated, I think, in some stuff I did after the book, right? And the idea is, I don't do much epistemology in the book. I just say, look, I think there's parity of evidence, so we should take this seriously, and then I run with the metaphysics, right? And frankly, the book, even if like tomorrow there was some really good reason to think that there was nothing to the phenomenon, I think the book would still work as a thought experiment in metaphysics, okay? Mm-hmm. Right? But so what I meant by dark knowledge is to take up all of these, I think, really deep epistemological problems of knowledge that are raised by the phenomenon, okay? So, and here's what I have in mind is a couple of I think there's a couple of like circular problems that are going to come up here, right? So here's the kind of the easier one to get. If we admit now, right, that the classic UFO lore story is true, right? That there's been, you know, there had been crashes in the 1940s, and that's systematically been hid from us, et cetera, et cetera. And then now authorities are coming out and telling us that this is true. There's a self-defeating problem there. Right. There's sort of, okay. So, like, if I say to you, I've been lying to you for 80 years until now, well, there's a real problem. Like, why would I think that you're not lying to me now?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so it seems like you get it, if disclosure happens, there's something self-defeating about disclosure, right? From an epistemological standpoint. Okay. And I think, like, maybe more subtly is, let's suppose like the classic UFO lore story were true, and there are aliens, they've been involved in our history, you know, maybe they like cajoled human evolution in certain ways, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well then right there, then now you got a problem. It's like, were we set up to understand things, or were we set up to understand or believe certain things that these outside intelligences have designed us to do? Do you see that? And so once again, I think it goes self-defeating there. Okay. So what I mean by dark knowledge is I'm not sure that like disclosure would be anything but ultimately self-defeating, right? That it wouldn't give us knowledge. It would only give us skepticism, right? And yeah. So that's what I have in mind there.
I've said many times, folks who have the idea, and this is purely same as yourself, it's just opinion, just speculation, mm-hmm. but any form of disclosure wouldn't give you the answers to all the questions. It would just give you a whole new set of questions.
Right.
And again, like you say, any non-human intelligence that comes down and says, okay, here's everything you need to know. Yeah, but then what if an alternative race of non-human intelligences appear and say, actually, that's not quite correct. Yeah. Here's some info. Who do you then go with?
Right.
And I'm very much agree with you on that it would throw up a lot more questions than answers. But how do we then?
There's no way out of this without saying human knowledge has been monkeyed with in a serious way, one way or another. Yeah.
How do we deal with that though? The idea that many folks listening or watching this will think we're going to get disclosure, capital D disclosure, at some point in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. What's the best way to go ahead with that? Forget the blue sky picture that tomorrow aliens land, we get all the great new free technology, all illnesses are cured, you know, we can all stop working, money's not a thing anymore, and we can live in the Galactic Federation, which is incredibly unlikely. And it's a very real scenario. How do we actually go forward with that in any kind of trusting way?
I don't think we can. Right. I think there's going to be this very, very nagging question that should be associated with it at every step of the way. Right. Do you see my point? That's why I call it dark. Right.
Yeah.
I think disclosure will cast more shadows than it does light. Right. Because if indeed, you know, there has been like a grand scale systematic deception is going on here. Right. Well, that means we're in a world where grand scale systematic deceptions can go on. Right. And so now, Descartes' demon is on the loose now. Right. If indeed humans are, according to the lore, right, are somehow the products of some kind of engineering by an alien race or something like that, right? I'm not saying that's the case at all, right? But that's part of the lore. So, for example, if that came to be the case too, well, then it seems like we don't know what our knowing faculties were designed for. Were they designed for truth or just to believe certain things that these things want us to believe, right? And so I think no matter what, if disclosure happens or if the lore becomes something that we can affirm, you're going to have this circular self-defeating problem that's going to come to it. And I don't know what an answer to that even looks like.
I wonder, as a society, a lot of folks would prescribe to the idea that where we are now, we're ready for disclosure. We can cope with it. You know, if you look at one of the last big global events, COVID, whatever side of those arguments you fall down on, people don't believe either side of the arguments, regardless of what evidence is presented. We can see the same thing right now with the US elections. You know, one side says this, the other side says this. People kind of pick their camps, don't they? And I think we've probably done that as a society for many, many decades or centuries. Are we set up to face disclosure that we are ready for it now? And I wonder, do you think there's ever been a time we may have been better placed? Because like you say, I get the feeling tomorrow we find out non-human intelligence is genuine, our government discloses it, it would just throw up a whole load of social media of false flag, this is what they want you to believe, this isn't real, this isn't genuine, and other camps of these are our saviors, you know, this is the way forward, and everything else in between.
Yeah, I think you're articulating the box I fear that we're trapped in. Okay, it wouldn't, like right now, I don't think it would matter if it's UFO disclosure or the second coming of Christ,
yeah,
or you know what I mean, or the finally the great the great Marxist revolutionary leader, whatever, right? It doesn't seem that we're in a position to believe anything now, because we have become so mistrustful of any attempt to disseminate information, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we're necessarily wrong to have that distrust, but that's the situation we're in, right?
How do you see us getting out of that as a society? Because you're right that no matter what the subject is, and I suppose a good one to break away from UFOs, just as an example, as that second coming of Christ, how something like that would even unfold now with social media? And is social media a big part of the issue there then?
Yeah, of course, right? I mean, I think social media is an incredible part of it. I mean, just think of the role of social media, using the example of the UFO, like the role that social media plays in the sort of UFO subculture is absolutely central. Absolutely central. Like, would you be involved with it if it weren't for social media? You know?
I had an interest growing up. Don't know if I'd have this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like
if you're still talking about VHS libraries, newsletters, it would certainly wouldn't be to the level. Probably not. No.
Yeah. So I love the question you're raising here, Andy. Is what would the second coming of Christ look like as mediated through Instagram?
Yeah.
Because that's going to be a problem now, right? Like for anything, is there's always been this problem with it as well. In the era of social media, there's no reason to think that what you're seeing isn't faked, right? Mm. There's no reason to think that what you're seeing isn't a put on, right? Or you can find plenty of people disagree with it, or plenty of people agree with it, and it'll come to about even on that. So good luck, right? Yeah. And you ask how to go forward. I don't know. And I don't think anyone knows. I think this is like the fundamental problem of our moment, right? And the problem is people running things are enjoying the benefits of this too much to stop it, right?
Yeah.
But I do think, though, like what we're doing, this conversation and the conversation you're going to have with other people, and the conversation you're having with, you know, people in your groups, right? This is important because we're actually talking about stuff and we're admitting the skeptical nature of our situation. We're admitting that we don't know things, and we're giving each other latitude to be wrong. I think that's an important thing too, is to like, I was just listening to a podcast before we went on, and it was about two people who were having a debate just recently about stuff that happened during the pandemic, right? And one of them was clearly wrong about something, and the other person just wasn't letting them admit that, it wasn't enough just to let this guy admit he was wrong. It was like he had to be punished publicly for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that's one of the problems with all of this stuff, is there's no permission to be wrong, right? And so that means you're always going to stick to our camps and the people who are protecting us in that camps, and here we go, right? So I do think, though, if there is something like a way of going forward, it's something like these longer format things where we come on and we can talk about things and say, hey, I'm not sure. Maybe a year from now, I'll be shown to be wrong, but that's okay, right? But I know that's a very thin thread of hope, right?
Yeah, no. And I've recommended many times on this podcast a wonderful debate between two very extremely different people, is one with Ben Shapiro and Russell Brand.
Sure.
Literally sitting at a cafe table talking about their ideals of what life is for them, family values. You know,
at Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Political beliefs, religious beliefs.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to listen to, because you might agree with some or all or none of what they say, but it's great to listen to two people sit across from each other and say, I don't agree with that at all, but okay.
Yeah.
And be able to be adults about it, which was really interesting, because I think that's probably lacking in modern day, to be honest. And permission to be wrong, like you say, is the, for someone to say, oh, I got that wrong, so yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Doesn't negate everything else someone's done. or said or will do or could do or contribute. And I think there's an element of that cancel culture that people need to be punished. Like you say, you made a mistake, and it's more than likely the camp against that person's been waiting on that mistake. Yep. And that's it. Now you go for the jugular, don't you?
Exactly. Right. But do you see my broader point on the dark knowledge thing is that I think we have to realize that whatever it would count for what we are and what we want out of disclosure, got it. It's not clear that that's going to do anything to clarify the waters whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to get to some listener questions to finish off. I had one or two more questions that are quite either sides of the same coin before then. You mentioned earlier coming into researching or writing the book, you had an idea of what the UFO phenomenon may be in your own head. If someone came to you right now, you know, with you're doing a book signing in a Waterstones or whatever it might be in the US somewhere, and they ask you, you know, these UFOs, you know, what are they? In a few sentences, can you sum up what you would say to someone asking you, you know, what are UFOs?
Yeah, I would say a high percentage of them are probably, you know, classified military tech, right? I think some percentage of them, though all much smaller, is some kind of put on, right? And I think some small but very interesting percentage of them are humans in one way or another getting in touch with something that falls outside of the envelope of ordinary human perception and cognition, right? And in that way, they're quite anomalous in that that doesn't happen to us every day, as far as we know. But in other ways, they're not terribly anomalous because humans always seem to have been troubled by such things like that, right?
Yeah.
And so for that reason, I even try now to even use the word UFO less and less, right? Because immediately it goes to a certain narrative about it, right? But yeah, so I think what we're doing is we're bumping into, some of us are, I haven't, right? But I think people do bump into things from outside the normal human perceptual envelope. Right. And that's what ultimately gets the moniker UFO for our era. Right.
Yeah. I like that. That's a good answer. One that will get certainly the other folks thinking. I know that much. And Is there an element of this whole UFO phenomenon that you struggle with to get your head around, whether it's because of a belief or otherwise any aspect of it?
Yeah. So I think for me, just if you look at the way I theorize it, you know, people like to divide the UFO question into, you know, the nuts and bolts phenomena and what and the high strangeness phenomena. Okay. I think my theories make better sense of high strangeness than they do nuts and bolts, right? Where people actually know that it left tracks on the lawn kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because on my theory, there would have to be these entire technological systems out there that we're not aware of that are doing these things, right? So I'll say, yeah, I do wonder how well my particular framing of it that I do in the book fits the nuts and bolts issue. I think I can make it work, but I think every theory has a weakness, and that's where my theory's weak point is.
Awesome. Listen, let's get to some questions from listeners, and thank you to everyone who got in touch. First question is from Algo. Maybe short for algorithm, I like that, or just Algo is a cool name. Many accounts of humans encountering UAP or non-human intelligences are similar in that us humans stay passive or follow their lead. Typical human reactions such as a fight or flight seem to be rare. Any idea why that is?
Well, actually, I don't know how typical flight or flight really is. Okay, so anyone who's like studied trauma, right, will tell you that there's also a reaction that's in humans and we share with lots and lots of other animals to when really stressed out, we just shut down, right? That we become very passive, like play dead in some ways, not literally necessarily, but play dead, okay? And you see this a lot in traumatized individuals, human beings, okay? So the fact that when people are absolutely confronted with something beyond the normal envelope of human perception and cognition, that they would just shut down, become passive, you know, be almost catatonic. I think there's evidence of people doing that in traumatic situations all the time, right? And then returning to that same sort of catatosis after the fact. So I actually think that makes good sense.
Thanks for that. Cheers, Algo. Dave Smethurst gets in touch. Nice to hear from you, Dave. He asks, discussing the nature of UFOs, their occupants and related phenomena has linked to the nature of reality and ideas of transcendence. Much of this, the discussion and the community seems similar to old ideas of reality being the mind of God and Gnostic ideas of transcendence. How far does Dr. Madden think these old models are being used in the community? How useful are they, and are they unhelpful, distorting the discussion of the nature of the phenomenon and how we should react to it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to a lot of those kinds of models metaphysically, but I just don't know that they're actually suggested by the UFO phenomenon. Okay, so my take, as you can see from our prior conversation here, is to actually look at the way human perception works. Okay, because what's going on in the UFO phenomenon? People are claiming to see things, to hear things, to have been touched by things, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So I think what we need to do is then to start out with human perception, right? That's where we start out. Okay. And get a sense of how human perception actually works and what evidence that might shed on what these things actually are. Okay. And that's how my model works, is it is, once we look at the way human perception works, that it sorts for relevance for practical tasks, et cetera, et cetera. Then we can start to see that maybe what we're getting here isn't necessarily an otherworldly, you know, encounter. It's an encounter with something that is very much a part of this world, but just not a part of the world that we're normally keyed into, given our evolutionary history, right?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times in the UFO in ufology, there's this jump to very extravagant metaphysics, right? Very extravagant forms of idealistic and quasi-Gnostic metaphysics, right? Which I think a case can be made for those things, but I don't think that case needs to be hitched to specifically analyzing what people are seeing in the UFO.
Awesome. Thank you. Question from Max Young. And this is the one I mentioned to you, Jim, before we spoke. I'm going to ask it, and I'm going to ask you to simplify it to what it actually means for the audience. And that's, if anyone understands it, great, but I had to go and check it out as well. So people are going to hear it and go, what does that mean? I'm sure. Please discuss the realism and idealism dichotomy and what UFOs tell us about Jungian archetypes and the collective unconscious.
Sure. Okay, so let me take the easier part first, which is the second part of the question. So what does the UFO tell us about Jungian archetypes and the collective unconscious? Okay. So first of all, anything I would say about this is sort of bullshit, because Carl Jung wrote a book about it, which is far better than anything I could say about it. Okay, so I certainly recommend everybody go look at Carl Jung's book, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky, which I still think is the unsurpassed classic in this field, right? I have a great admiration for Jung's book. Okay. Now, what might the UFO, independently even of what Jung says, like what might the UFO tell us about the role of archetypes and the collective unconscious? Okay. Well, I think it fits really well with how I think about things, in that, so what the archetypes are for Jung, it are basically, there's a set of information types or basic structures for interpreting reality that he sees us as inheriting throughout all of human history, right? That and so this is why he thinks that, like, if you go to, you know, a culture in ancient North America, you go to a culture in ancient Mesopotamia, and a culture in like ancient Southeast Asia, their myths all have kind of the same basic structure. Like you have the hero's journey is going on there. There's always the wise old man. There's always like the overbearing mother. Okay. That all the myths have these same structures to them. You can see it in the biblical myths. You can see it in other monotheistic myths, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And so Jung thinks that there's this basic set of instinctual knowledge, right, that is necessary for getting around in the world to live a human life, right? That's necessary for happiness. And it's all coded in these inherited myths that get passed down through something he calls the collective unconscious. Okay. Now, and then when the chips are down, what do we do for Jung? We interpret our lives in terms of these archetypes, right? Like And he's like, this is a good thing, right? Because if we had to make it all up every generation, we would never get anywhere. Okay. Well, think of it now. So what, like, it then seems that there's an unconscious structuring to our experience, right? And so that when the chips are down in our lives, we draw on these unconscious archetypes to interpret for us what's going on. Well, Jung sees something like this in the UFO, right? So he's writing in the 1950s. And he says, wow, it's interesting. Like, we're living in a time where humans have experienced anxieties on a scale they never have before. We just got out of our second world war in less than, 50 years. We're facing a cold war that this time we're talking nuclear Armageddon if this thing goes sideways, right? And then now people are having dreams and having experiences that involve circular objects, okay? And these circular objects are telling them to do things like get over, you know, like move beyond the Cold War, move beyond the violence, move beyond all these things, right? And Jung sees the circular object is a symbol. It's a perennial symbol cross-culturally for completeness, for wholeness, for return, right? All these things. And Jung says, well, it's not surprising that at a moment when we're under our greatest stress as a race that we've ever been under, as a species that we've ever been under, that we're going to start seeing these kinds of messages, right? And it could be, Jung says, simply a communication from ourselves to ourselves, from the collective unconscious, from our archetypes, or it could be something else is trying to reach us and it knows these archetypes are the best ways to communicate to us. Okay. So Jung ends up rather ambiguously here as to whether or not this is something beyond us or this is something within us, right? Yeah. And going to the earlier part of the question, in the book, Jung actually comes to the point where he says, I don't know, maybe because he's worried. He says, yeah, on the one hand, I really think it's our psychological projection onto reality. It's a message from us to us through the collective unconscious. But then he also says, but you can pick these things up on radar. They leave tracks in the ground. Hmm. So it looks like the distinction between the ideal and the material, right, is breaking down now for Jung in a way. And you see him do the same thing with synchronicities. Okay. So that's my take. I mean, that's my understanding of what Jung was up to. And I agree with all of that, right? Right. And you can see how it plays a role in some of what I'm doing, where I think, yeah, we have that holy F moment where we see something beyond the pale. And what do? We interpret it in terms of the archetypes that we're carrying around given our cultural moments, right?
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
That's how I think about it, right?
Yeah. And I'll just say you've broken that down well because I understood that. So thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Very good.
Last question.
20 years of teaching undergraduates, Andy, have gotten me something.
It got you to the point. You managed to explain a question well to a UFO podcaster. So exactly. It must be a great... I'll send you a certificate for that one. You'll want to put it up on the wall. Last question is from a listener who gets in touch with some wonderful questions. Now, it's got quite a bit of context to it, so I'm going to read the full thing because I think you'll appreciate it more. So thank you to Newman, who gets in touch regularly with these questions. Religious organizations can be seen as control systems that mainly legitimize themselves using myths and miracles. Further, they draw power from the fellowship of their believers by offering them in return answers about great unknowns, such as the meaning of life, and positioning themselves as stewardship and representative of the divine and important life events, birth, marriage, death. By this, religious organizations worldwide were able to significantly shape the minds and societies of populations worldwide for centuries. In contrast to it, we find that UFOs are part of the modern myths and miracles of our time, and mystics of our time likewise like to bring UFOs forward as an explanation of our great unknowns, for example, implicating them in playing a role in the harvesting and reincarnation of souls on Earth. But who benefits from legitimizing himself from myths and miracles of UFOs? And what role can we expect the belief in UFOs to play in the reshaping of the minds and society of a global population? Can the belief in UFOs be compared directly to older religious belief systems, or do we find already significant differences at surface level?
Yeah, that's a great question. Part of me, I want to say, you should get in touch with Diana Pasulka, because this is definitely her wheelhouse, right?
Diana's been on twice, and hopefully I'll get her back on in the near future. Yeah,
good. But okay, so let me leave the joke aside, a legitimate caveat. Like this is a question for a scholar of religion, and like what a philosopher does is I don't necessarily explain what religion is, what it does. I can discuss like how good of our reasons for being religious or something like that. Okay. So that being said, I will speculate here though. Okay. And one thing in the question though, was it Newman? Was the
Newman? Yeah.
Yeah. Newman. So thanks for a great question, Newman. Is Newman asks, you know, okay, so who would benefit from this? Who would benefit from this new UFO religion? Okay. And I don't mean to pick at you, Newman, but I think that's a little too flat-footed way of thinking about how religion works. Okay. Cause it's not like somebody sat down and just planned out, and maybe this is being unfair to Newman, but like it's not as though somebody sat down and planned out like the major religious organizations, like we would plan out a business model, right? These are things that evolved from very lowly grassroots origins over thousands and thousands of years. Okay. So it's not as if someone said, I would get a lot out of this if I made up this story about this guy named, you know, Jesus, right? And then we could sell it and then we would benefit from it. It's that certain of these stories, maybe because they're true, maybe not, right? Okay, I have my own views there. But they were very effective in fulfilling certain human needs, and then thereby institutionally they grow and grow and grow and grow. And eventually you get a situation where, yeah, there are institutionally privileged people very much benefiting from what has come about here, right? But that doesn't mean that that's the origin of it, and that doesn't mean that's all it does. And it might still be that it does fill a legitimate human need, right? And I think the idea that there is a legitimate, very natural human need for something like religion, I think there's some great evolutionary psychology on that. I would encourage one to look at work by a guy named Matt Rossano, with just as a footnote there. Okay. And so now going back more directly to Newman's questions, like what, who might be benefit, right? What might come of something like a nascent UFO religion? Well, I think that's something that like we could only know that retrospectively. Right. Like after, like if this thing takes off, if it does start to fill human needs, right. And then looking back on it hundreds of years later or dozens of years later, then maybe we can answer those questions. But I think like ideas and religions and things like that are kind of like little organisms, little hyper objects that, you know, they start out lowly and they can get out on their own and get out of hand and take on lives of their own, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So I think we don't know where this could go, right? In the same way, probably no one in the first century in Palestine had any idea what Christianity would become, right? They wouldn't have even called it Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. It's just what they were doing, right? It's just what they were experiencing, what was happening to them, okay? Now, that being said, I do think, you know, there are people who seem to really want to push this as a religion. There have been cults surrounding it, right? A lot of it does sort of dovetail, I think, conveniently with a lot of New Age stuff, right? And so I think the idea that it does have religious aspects to it and is thereby subject to the same critiques. I have a chapter of this in my book, right? That it does have religious aspects to it and is thereby subject to the same critiques that religions have had to endure, I think we have to note and we have to insist on those critiques.
Yeah, I don't think that's unfair. And I think you see that through various iterations of the UFO topic. And I think you're right when you say your entry to the subject was 2017, the New York Times article, and forgetting the X-Files past, all that kind of stuff. That was something you went, wow, maybe there's something to this. Is akin to someone walking down the street going through a difficult time in their life and being handed a Gideon's Bible or, you know, meeting you know, some Scientologists and thinking, maybe this is the time I need to start looking at this stuff.
Yeah.
And that's where they follow. You've got people who can be seen as leaders in the UFO topic. different facets of it as well.
It would be like this. It'd be like if you were in first century Rome, right, and you happened to pick up an after action report from whoever was running the Roman Legion, you know, the week they crucified Jesus. Mm. And the guy in the after action report was like, I don't know, man, the tomb was empty. I can't lie. The tomb was empty. Right. Like,
yeah,
that would do something for you. Right. You know, I think it's something similar to what happens in 2017. Right.
Yeah. I always advise that, again, just my opinion, people make up their own minds, but listen to people's opinions, but definitely make up your own mind on things. You don't have to follow someone's belief system blindly because it's theirs. But people do put a lot of faith and trust in folks. I do as well. I've got folks in the UFO field that I'll listen to more than others, but there's no one person or people that I'll put every single egg in the basket I'll see anymore.
Something I did find interesting, like in all the senses of interesting, when I first got into the UFO stuff, is a lot of the people in the UFO world seem to think of themselves as secular. Not all of them, right? But a lot of them seem to see themselves as secular, right? But then are kind of blinded to the religious aspects of ufology. And once again, I think like the same critiques that we can level against, you know, the Western monotheistic religions that come from people like Freud and Nietzsche, you could level those same critiques against many of the claims of ufology, right? And I say this as, you know, I'm basically a religious guy. You know, like the same critiques that my religion, I think, rightly subject to, and I should worry about, and I should address, I should be honest about, I think ufology has to admit that those same things are available for it, and it needs to look those squarely in the face. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not unfair at all. And listen, you've been wonderful. That's almost 90 minutes you've been with us, Jim. Cool. I just want to finish up asking you, you know, what you see your continuing role going forward being in the subject of UFOs, if indeed it's something you want to stay invested and involved in.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one I'm trying to answer right now. You know, so I, you know, the book's out. I just, you know, last spring I was filmed for a documentary that Ontocalypse is doing called The Beyond, right?
Yep.
So I'll be appearing in that. But I'm really committed to not becoming a grifter. Okay, so like, it's very, as we all should, right?
Popular buzzword for some in the community, but yeah, I get it.
Yeah, I mean, well, because it would be very easy for me to like now ask myself, okay, how do I stay relevant? Right. You know what I mean? Like, how do I stay in this? Okay. But that's not how philosophy should work. Like, it should just be, do I have an idea that's relevant? Right.
Yeah.
Like, I shouldn't write another book because I want to have an idea. I should write another book because I already have an idea. Right. And so, so right now I think I need to like shut up and read and listen and think and work on other stuff. And if more ideas that are relevant to the field come up, I'll do them, right? I'll write them up. I'll do it. And I'm happy to come and talk to people about stuff, but I'm really resisting the idea of taking the temptation to like, just to like define what I'm doing as an intellectual as what keeps me relevant in this movement. Right.
Yeah. That's a very fair answer. And I've always said from the beginning for myself, I only wanted to start this that I felt I had something different to offer that maybe I didn't feel was out there already. Yeah. Not better, not worse, just different. And I think that's a good place to be, that if you feel you can do that. And otherwise, if I felt I was just copying someone else, what's the point?
Yeah.
Then it is probably grifting. But yeah, I'll let others make their mind up on that as they quite readily do. But listen, Jim, been wonderful speaking with you. Glad to finally get you on. The book Unidentified Flying Hyperobject, UFOs, Philosophy and the End of the World is available at the link in the description. And I suggest people pick that up because, again, there's so many books on the UFO topic. And it's just one, again, that comes at it from that different point of view, especially if you're a fan of Kiel, Valet, Pasulka, a different line of thinking. It's one to add to your collection, so I would recommend it, James.
Thank you very much, man. Appreciate it, Andy. Anytime. Cool. That's right. So I should leave this browser open, right?
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a Tic Tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right at the bottom.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.